Chapter 5. At midnight, beneath a starry sky, a man dressed in a suit and a slouch hat like a railroad official worked hand and foot levers to propel a three-wheeled Kalamazoo Velocipede track inspection vehicle between Burbank and Glendale. The track was smooth on this recently completed section of the San Francisco to Los Angeles line. Rowing with his arms and pedaling with his feet, he was making nearly 20 miles per hour in eerie silence, broken only by the rhythmic clicking of the wheels passing over the joints between the rails. The velocipede was used to watch over the section gangs who replaced worn or rotted cross ties, tamped stone ballast between the ties, aligned rails, pounded down loose spikes, and tightened bolts. Its frame, two main wheels, and the outrigger that connected them to its side wheel were made of strong, light ash, its treads of cast iron. The entire vehicle weighed less than 150 pounds. One man could lift it off the rails and turn it in the opposite direction or get out of the way of a train. The wrecker, no cripple except when he needed a disguise, would have no trouble tumbling it down an embankment when he was done with it. Tied to the empty seat beside him were a crowbar, track wrench, spike puller, and a device that no section gang would dare leave on the rails. It was a hook, nearly 2 feet long, fashioned from a cast-iron boat anchor from which one fluke had been removed. He had stolen the velocipede. He had broken into a clapboard building at the edge of the Burbank Freight Depot, where the Southern Pacific Section Inspector stored it, and manhandled it onto the rails. In the unlikely event that some cinder dick or village constable saw him and asked what the hell he was doing riding the main line at midnight, his suit and hat would buy him 2 seconds of hesitation, ample time to deliver a silent answer with the blade in his boot. Leaving the lights of Burbank behind, rolling past darkened farmhouses, he quickly adjusted to the starlight. Half an hour later, 10 miles north of Los Angeles, he slowed down, recognizing the jagged angles and dense layers of latticework of an iron trestle crossing a dry riverbed. He trundled across the trestle. The rails curved sharply to the right to parallel the riverbed. He stopped a few yards after he felt the wheels click across a joint where two rails butted together. He unloaded his tools and knelt down on the crushed stone ballast, cushioning his knees on a wooden cross-tie. Feeling the joint between the rails in the dark with his fingers, he located the fish plate, the flat piece of metal fastening the rails to each other. He pried up the spike that anchored the fish plate to the tie with his spike puller. Then he used his track wrench to loosen the nuts on the 4 bolts that secured the fish plate to the rails and yanked them out. Tossing 3 of the bolts and nuts and the fish plate down the steep embankment, where even the sharpest-eyed engineer could not see them in his headlight, he threaded the last bolt through a hole in the shank of the hook. He swore at a sudden stab of sharp pain. He had cut his finger on a metal burr. Cursing the drunken blacksmith who hadn't bothered to file smooth the edges of the hole he had drilled, he wrapped his finger in a handkerchief to stop the bleeding. Clumsily, he finished screwing the nut on the bolt. With the wrench, he made it tight enough to hold the hook upright. The open end faced west, the direction from which the coastline limited would come. The coastline was a flyer, one of the fast-through passenger trains that sped across long distances between cities. Routed via new tunnels through the Santa Susana Mountains, from Santa Barbara to Oxnard, Burbank, and Glendale, she was bound for Los Angeles. Suddenly, the wrecker felt the rail vibrate. He jumped to his feet. The Coastline Limited was supposed to be running late tonight. If that was she had made up a lot of time. If it wasn't, then he had gone to great effort and taken dangerous risks to derail a worthless milk train. A train whistle moaned. Quickly he grabbed the spike puller and yanked up spikes that were holding the rail to the wooden ties. He managed to pry 8 loose before he saw a glow of a headlight up the line. He threw the spike puller down the steep embankment and jumped onto the velocipede and pedaled hard. Now he heard the locomotive. The sound was faint in the distance, but he recognized the distinctive, clean, sharp huff of an Atlantic 442. It was the Limited, all right, and he could gauge by the rapid beat of the steam exhausted from her smokestack that she was coming fast. The Atlantic 442 pulling the Coastline Limited was built for speed. Her engineer, Rufus Patrick, loved her for it. The American Locomotive Company of Schenectady, New York, had fitted her with enormous 80-inch drive wheels. At 60 miles per hour, the four-wheeled engine truck in front held her on the rails as steady as the Rock of Ages, while a two-wheeled truck in back supported a big firebox to generate plenty of superheated steam. Rufus Patrick would admit that she was not that strong. The new, heavier steel passenger cars coming along soon would demand the more powerful Pacifics. She was no mountain climber, but for blazing speed on a flat, pulling a crack flyer of wooden passenger cars across long distances, she was not to be beat. Her identical sister had been clocked the previous year at 127.1 miles per hour, a speed record unlikely to be bested any time soon, thought Patrick. At least not by him, not even tonight, running late. Not when he was hauling 10 passenger cars full of folks hoping to get home safe. 60 was just fine, flying at a mile a minute. The locomotive's cab was crowded. In addition to Rufus Patrick and his fireman, Zeke Taggart, there were two guests. Bill Wright, an official of the Electrical Workers Union who was a friend of Rufus's, and Bill's nephew, his namesake Billy, whom he was accompanying to Los Angeles, where the boy was to begin an apprenticeship in a laboratory that developed celluloid film for moving pictures. When they had last stopped for water, Rufus had walked back to the baggage car, where they were stealing a free ride, and invited them up to the cab. 14-year-old Billy couldn't believe his amazing luck to be riding in a locomotive. He'd been mooning over trains rumbling past his house his whole life and been up all night excited about this trip. But he had never dreamed he could actually ride up front in the cab. Mr. Patrick wore a striped cap just like you saw in pictures and was the surest, calmest man Billy had ever seen. He had explained what he was doing every step of the way as he sounded two long blasts on the whistle and started the train moving again. "We're off, Billy. I'm dropping the Johnson bar to full forward. All the way forward to go ahead, all the way back for reverse. We can go just as fast backward as forward." Patrick gripped a long horizontal bar. "Now I'm opening the throttle, sending steam to the cylinders to turn the drive wheels, and I'm opening the sand valve to get adhesion on the rails. Now I'm pulling back on the throttle so we don't start too fast. You feel her bite? And not slipping?" Billy had nodded eagerly. She had picked up speed smooth as silk as Patrick began notching out the throttle. Now rolling toward Glendale on the last few miles before Los Angeles, blowing the whistle at grade crossings, Patrick told the awestruck boy, "You'll never drive a finer locomotive. She's a good steamer and rides easy." The fireman, Zeke Taggart, who had been steadily shoveling coal into the roaring firebox, banged the door shut and sat down to catch his breath. He was a big man, black and greasy, and stunk of sweat. "Billy," he boomed in a huge voice, "see this here glass?" Taggart tapped a gauge. "It's the most important window on the train. It shows the water level in the boiler. Too low, the crown sheet heats up and melts, and boom, blows us all to kingdom come." "Don't pay him no mind, Billy," Patrick said. "It's Zeke's job to make sure we've got plenty in the boiler. We've got a tender full of water right behind us."
"How come the throttle's in the middle?" asked Billy.
"It sits in the middle when we're rolling. Right now, that's all we need to be steaming at 60 miles an hour. Shove her forward, we'd be doing 120. The engineer winked at Uncle Bill. "The throttle lever also helps us steer her around tight bends. Zeke, do you see any curves coming up?" "Trestle just ahead, Rufus. Tight bend turning out of it." "You take her, son."
"What?"
"Steer her around the curve. Quick now, grab hold. Poke your head out here and look." Billy took the throttle in his left hand and leaned out the window the same way the engineer had. The throttle was hot, pulsing in his hand like it was alive. The beam of the locomotive headlight gleamed along the rails. Billy saw the trestle coming up. It looked very narrow. "Just a light touch," Rufus Patrick cautioned with another wink at the men. "Hardly need to move it at all."
"Easy, easy."
"Yep, you're getting the hang of it. But you gotta get her right down the middle. It's a mighty tight fit."
Zeke and Uncle Bob exchanged grins.
"Look out now."
"Yep, you're doing fine.
Just ease her."
"What's that up ahead, Mr. Patrick?"
Rufus Patrick looked where the boy was pointing.
The beam of the locomotive headlight was throwing shadows and reflections from the ironwork in the trestle, which made it hard to see. Probably just a shadow. Suddenly, the headlight glinted on something strange.
"What the—"
In the company of a child, Patrick automatically switched cuss words to blue blazes. It was a hooked hunk of metal reaching up from the right rail like a hand from a shallow grave.
"Hit the air!" Patrick yelled to the fireman.
Zeke threw himself on the air brake lever and yanked it with all his might. The train slowed so violently it seemed to hit a wall, but only for a moment. An instant later, the weight of 10 fully loaded passenger cars and a tender filled with tons of coal and water hurled the locomotive forward. Patrick clapped his own experienced hand on the air brake. He worked the brakes with the fine touch of a clockmaker and eased the Johnson bar into reverse. The great drive wheels spun, screeching in a blaze of fiery sparks, shaving slivers of steel from the rails. The brakes and the reversing drivers decelerated the speeding coastline limited. But it was too late. The high-wheeled Atlantic 442 was already screaming through the trestle, bearing down on the hook, still making 40 miles per hour. Patrick could only pray that the wedge-shaped pilot, the so-called cowcatcher that swept along the tracks in front of the locomotive, would sweep it aside before it caught the engine truck's front axle. Instead, the iron hook that the wrecker had bolted to the loosened rail latched onto the pilot with a death grip. It tore loose the rail ahead of the front wheels on the right side of the 186,000-pound locomotive. Her massive drive wheels crashed onto the ties, bouncing on wood and ballast at 40 miles an hour. The speed, the weight, and the relentless momentum crushed the edge of the bed and ground the ties to splinters. The wheels dropped into air, and still racing forward, the engine began to careen onto its side, dragging its tender with it. The tender pulled the baggage car over the edge, and the baggage car dragged the first passenger car with it before the coupling to the second passenger car broke free. Then, almost miraculously, the locomotive seemed to right itself. But it was a brief respite. Shoved by the weight of the tender and cars, it twisted and turned and skidded down the embankment, sliding until it smashed its mangled pilot and headlight into the rock-hard bottom of the dry riverbed. It stopped at last, tilted at a steep angle, with its nose down and its trailing truck in the air. The water in the tightly sealed boiler, which was superheated to 380 degrees, spilled forward, off the red-hot crown plate, which was at the back of the boiler.
"Get out!" roared the engineer. "Get out before she blows!"
Bill was sprawled unconscious against the firebox. Little Billy was sitting dazed on the footplate, holding his head. Blood was pouring through his fingers. Zeke, like Patrick, had braced for the impact and not been hurt badly.
"Grab Bill," Patrick told Zeke, who was a powerful man. "I've got the boy."
Patrick slung Billy under his arm like a gunny sack and jumped for the ground. Zeke draped Bill right over his shoulder, leaped from the engine, and hit the steep gravel slope running. Patrick stumbled with the boy. Zeke grabbed Patrick with his free arm and kept him upright. The crashing sounds had ceased abruptly. In the comparative quiet, they could hear injured passengers screaming in the first car, which was crumpled open like Christmas wrapping paper.
"Run!"
The coal fire that Zeke Taggart had shoveled so hard to feed was still raging under the locomotive's crown plate, burning fiercely to maintain the 2,200 degrees necessary to boil 2,000 gallons of water. It continued to heat the steel. But with no water above it to absorb the heat, the temperature of the steel soared from its normal 600 degrees to the fire's 2,200. At that temperature, the half-inch-thick plate softened like butter in a skillet. 200 pounds per square inch steam pressure inside the boiler was 14 times ordinary air pressure outside. It took only seconds for the captive steam to exploit the sudden weakness and burst a hole in the crown plate. Even as the steam escaped, 2,000 gallons of water pressure-cooked to 380 degrees also turned to steam the instant it came in contact with the chill Glendale air. Its volume multiplied by 1,600 times. In a flash, 2,000 gallons of water vaporized into 3 million gallons of steam. Trapped inside the 442 Atlantic's boiler, it expanded outward with a concussive roar that exploded the steel locomotive into 1 million small pieces of shrapnel. Billy and his uncle never knew what hit them, nor did the Wells Fargo Express messenger in the baggage car, nor three friends who had been playing draw poker in the front of the derailed Pullman. But Zeke Taggart and Rufus Patrick, who understood the cause and nature of the nightmarish forces gathering like a tornado, actually felt the unspeakable pain of scalding steam for a tenth of a second before the explosion ended all they knew forever. With the clang of cast iron on stone and the crackle of splintering ash, the Kalamazoo velocipede tumbled down the railroad embankment.
"What the hell is that?"
Jack Douglas, 92, was so old he'd started out as an Indian fighter, protecting the First Western Railroad's right-of-way. The company kept him on out of rare sentiment and let him act as a sort of night watchman, patrolling the quiet Glendale rail yard with a heavy single-action Colt 44 on his hip. He reached for it with a veined and bony hand and began sliding it with practiced ease from its oiled holster. The wrecker lunged with shocking swiftness. His thrust was so efficient that it would have caught a man his own age flat-footed. The watchman never had a chance. The telescoping sword was in his throat and out again before he crumpled to the ground. The wrecker looked down at the body in disgust. Of all the ridiculous things to go wrong. Jumped by an old geezer who should have been in bed hours ago. He shrugged and said, half aloud, with a smile, "Waste not, want not." Pulling a poster from his coat pocket, he crushed it into a ball. Then he knelt beside the body, forced open the dead hand, and closed the fingers around the crumpled paper. Dark and empty streets led to where the Southern Pacific rails crossed the narrow tracks of the Los Angeles and Glendale Electric Railway. The big green streetcars of the interurban passenger line did not run after midnight. Instead, taking advantage of inexpensive electricity purchased in bulk at night, the railway carried freight. Keeping a sharp eye for police, the wrecker hopped aboard a car filled with milk cans and fresh carrots bound for Los Angeles. It was growing light when he jumped off in the city and made his way across East 2nd Street. The dome of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway's Moorish-style La Grande Station was silhouetted against a lurid red dawn. He retrieved a suitcase from the luggage room and changed out of his dusty clothes in the men's room. Then he boarded the Santa Fe's flyer to Albuquerque and sat down to a breakfast of steak and eggs and fresh-baked rolls in a dining car set with silver and china. As the flyer's locomotive gathered way, the imperious conductor of the express passenger train came through, demanding, "Tickets, gents!" Affecting the brusque attitude of a man who traveled regularly for business, the wrecker did not bother to look up from his Los Angeles Times, which allowed him to keep his face down, concealing his features, as he wiped his fingers on a fine linen napkin and fished out his wallet. "You've cut your finger," said the conductor, staring at a bright red blood stain on the napkin. Stropping my razor, said the wrecker, still not looking up from his newspaper, while cursing again the drunken blacksmith he wished he had killed.